Hello, and welcome to another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org. And with me, I have my co-host and friend, Jed Hartley, son of a prophet and former member of International House of Prayer. Jed, you see me laughing every time I say that. I guess we're both laughing a little bit, but the audience can laugh at me today because I barely have any voice. I woke up with this morning, and I'm a good advertisement for Luden's cough drops because I can keep doing the podcast as long as I have these things by my side. My voice will last through the podcast even though I sound like this. But anyway,
is that a paid partnership, or is it, you got to get them on the...
As much as I've mentioned these things, I probably should ask them for a paid membership or partnership, but no, I just take them because this actually works and it does help you. So, but today we're talking about something fun. I was alone and I was reading your agenda for today, and I thought this is a good one for me to just be surprised when you start talking. I know we're all going to talk about the fasting, which I won't be surprised for that, because that really was fundamental to latter rain, and quite honestly, it was deceptive in the way that all of that played out. But the other parts of it, which I'll let you introduce, I think it's going to be shocking for me, and I think for some of the listeners who weren't in the International House of Prayer, they're going to be like, "What was that?"
Yeah, I think that there's so much overlap with a lot of the teaching between different latter rain ministers and whatnot, and so it's hard to find things that are just unique to a specific individual. But if I had to pinpoint something that was specific to IHOP KC that you don't see in other Latter Rain churches and other NAR churches or just even charismatic churches in general, it's starting to become more of a thing because of Mike Bickle. But one of the central teachings that we were taught at IHOP KC was what Mike Bickle called the bridal paradigm. And this bridal paradigm painted basically a lot of the whole ethos and environment of the community. It gave a very specific perspective on the end times, and kind of what we were doing at IHOP. So for you, John, if you haven't really heard much about the bridal paradigm, which Mike Bickle didn't invent this. He pulled it from some of the Christian mystics, and Saint Teresa of Avila and some others who had spoken about it in the past. Usually it was nuns who spoke about it. But just to give you kind of a brief overview of what the bridal paradigm is, it is weird, but it is a metaphor for the end times church and for the return of Jesus. And so there are some different passages that fuel this concept of the bridal paradigm. But the essential idea is that it paints the end times church as a bride who is waiting for the return of a groom to be married. And the bride is preparing herself to be married to this king or this groom who is returning. And so the themes of it are consecration, saving yourself for the king. It is overtly sexual. It plays on the Song of Solomon. So it uses a lot of like the actual sexual metaphors in the Bible. It was very weird growing up in this community because as like a teenager, you know, I and some of the other teenage boys and girls who grew up in it, we are hypersexual ourselves. And so we're reading into a lot of sexual things that aren't sexual things. And we feel like, you know, we get in trouble for our minds being dirty, thinking this thing that isn't sexual is sexual. And there was a lot of times where especially at One Thing conferences, there would be running jokes about, man, do they realize how sexual some of this stuff sounds? And nope, that was the point. That was the point, is that it was this sort of metaphor of a sexual relationship, consecrating yourself, keeping yourself a virgin for when the groom returns. A lot of people will probably even push back. Like, if you were in IHOP and you heard me say that, the maintaining your virginity for the return of the groom, I guarantee there would be a lot of bristling. If I even like told myself that 15 years ago, there would be like, oh no, that's not what it's about. But that is 100% what it was about. That's all of what the metaphor was. There's one of the central parables is the parable of the 10 virgins, which I don't know if you're familiar with the parable of the 10 virgins, but it's in Matthew 25. And the parable is there's 10 virgins who are waiting for the groom. And there's five foolish virgins and five prepared virgins. And it's all about, they all have lamps. And at some point during the night, the bridegroom is going to return. And they have oil in their lamps. And at a certain point, that oil runs out and the light dies out. And so the ones who are prepared have extra oil with them. And the ones who are unprepared and who are foolish don't have enough oil to get through the night. And so I've really never understood the biblical passage. Like, it's not one of my favorite parables anyway. But that's just the metaphor is that the groom is going to return. We have to be prepared. We have to maintain oil in our lamps for when the groom returns. So it explicitly sets Jesus as this groom and the bride as this, or sorry, and the church as this bride. And we are waiting with this sort of longing anticipation for the return of our king, for our groom, so that we may be married to him and we will save ourselves and we will suffer. Right, there's this sort of longing expectation, like we know that we will not be fulfilled until the groom returns. We know that there is a purpose and identity for us. There is a marriage for us. There is a love that is just around the corner, and we just have to wait. And if we aren't good enough, like if we aren't able to wait enough, if we aren't able to consecrate ourselves enough, if we aren't able to keep oil in our lamps, then we won't be prepared for when the groom returns. So it was explicitly about the end times too, of just like Jesus is going to return, and he's going to return in our lifetimes any second, like we have talked about, you know, in several of the previous episodes. That was a lot of the apocalyptic nature of IHOP KC, is we truly believed that the Lord was going to return in our day, in our time. But more so than just returning, he was going to return and marry the bride of Christ. And there was that sort of longing and expectation and anguish for not being with him. So that was the metaphor there.
So, man, I thought you were going to bring something new. This is just Latter Rain 101. We're talking about,
yeah,
in the Message cult, we called it the foolish virgin doctrine.
And okay,
like you said, it does come somewhat from the Bible. If you read, what is it, Matthew 27, 25, I think it's 25, talks about
25, yeah,
the parable of the foolish virgins, right? But what Latter Rain did was it tried to reuse that passage and that parable to insinuate that all non-cult churches were the quote-unquote foolish virgins. And because they didn't join into the revival, they didn't have the quote oil in their lamps. And so when Jesus returned, he was coming to return for his bride, which we also taught that it was us, and we're to marry Jesus. Now, I'm laughing only because I've studied it to ends that most people will not study. It's actually turned into somewhat of a common Christian doctrine. Whenever we began experiencing churches outside of the cult, I would constantly hear how we, the Gentiles, are the bride. And I was a little confused because I had thrown away all my cult doctrines and I had actually read the Bible. But you read all of the passages referring to the bride are usually referring to Jerusalem. In fact, Ezekiel 16, I think, Jerusalem is declared to be the faithless bride, the mother of all harlots, all of the things that we applied to the other churches.
Right.
Ezekiel 16 just really applies to the church, to Jerusalem. So it did spread throughout mainstream Christianity to some extent. But the sexual part is what I started chuckling when you were talking. Branham would teach we called it the foolish virgins doctrine, exactly what you're talking about. But he would go into the most rampant sex, openly talking about sex. And he he was saying that the female human was designed for the sole purpose of sex, to lure men into sex, and that no other animal, not a dog, not a hog, no other animal could stoop as low as the human female. And to top it off, in 1965, he shows up to church and he says, and he's a little surprised that there are women in there. I think he expected it to be all men. He said, now we're in a mixed audience. I did bring some papers describing these sex acts, how women during sex, he called it a wall-eyed condition. When during the female orgasm, the eyes change. Whatever it was he was talking about, he brought actual papers to show the men after church. So they went to sex and beyond.
Wow, that's fascinating. I had thought that there had been some overlap with Branham, and I knew that he had taught a bit about it. I didn't know how unique. Here I'm thinking the bridal paradigm is a unique thing to Mike Bickle and to this movement. Of course, it's just another repackaged Latter Rain thing. Of course, there's nothing new under the sun. The other Solomon passage that no one talks about. but yeah, so, well, A, it just strikes me how incredibly misogynistic some of this rhetoric is. And I don't even understand, because if you look at early Pentecostalism, a lot of what separated Pentecostalism, in my perspective, in a good way, from other denominations of Christianity was that it actually gave a voice to people who didn't have a voice. You know, you had in the early 1900s, you had the Azusa Street Revival. Suddenly there are Black men who otherwise couldn't have spoken in a lot of churches because of segregation, suddenly being given a voice. You had women who were given a voice to, you know, Amy Simple McPherson, who became this huge sort of mega church pastor. Because the idea of Pentecostalism, at least one of the central ideas to me, was this idea that the Holy Spirit can speak through anybody, and it gives this sort of decentralized access to all individuals to be the sort of like connection between God, that there doesn't have to be this like very strict liturgy, that you don't have to go through, you know, 8 years of to be get your degree in your seminary degree or something like that. You didn't have to be ordained by this specific church, which obviously all of that like decentralized lack of authority has led to a lot of the Wild West con artists becoming these huge individuals without any sort of checks and balances. But early on, it gave women and minorities a voice to speak in the church. And to see how misogynistic and just really afraid of women and afraid of sexuality and afraid of women's sexuality, but also it's not like it's just it's not this sort of puritanical, we're not going to talk about sex at all. There's this very sexual, they're preaching a sexual gospel while having deep-rooted misogyny towards women and women's bodies. That was definitely demonstrated with Mike himself, because if you think about this bridal paradigm that he was doing this whole setting this metaphor of there's God, and he is going to return, and he is going to be like the groom who returns to his church, and the bride is going to be prepared for him, and it sets up the metaphor of, you know, the church being the bride and Jesus being the bridegroom. Well, then he used that same sort of metaphor in his grooming of young women throughout, especially in the early days. I think that it probably continued. We have less testimonies from some of the younger women who have been involved with him in the last like 20 years. But for in the 80s, and the 90s, that was what Mike Bickle was doing to groom these young teenagers, was that he was giving these prophetic words to them about how he and this woman, there are several different women, but he, you know, when he was speaking to a particular woman, he would say that you and I shall unite in the future. That's the sort of like that one day we will be together. There's a problem. I've been delayed. The bridegroom has been delayed. We can't be together right now. The delay being he's married and has two children and is a leader of a church, and it's horrible, and she's a teenager. So of course they can't be together. But one day that is going to be solved. You know, my wife is going to die in an earthquake, and that is going to open up the door for us to be united. But until then, you have to consecrate yourself for me. You have to set yourself apart for me. And this is what he did. He tried to groom women to set themselves apart from him. Every time those women then grew up and had to like reckon with the fact that this was a nasty relationship and they went and married other individuals, he had this very weird neurotic like anger towards the men that they married. It's just super creepy stuff. So he sets up this sort of pattern. And I guess, I don't know, I guess now that I'm talking, I understand the misogyny of it, because if you have so little respect for women that you are doing all of this to destroying these young women's lives by trying to groom them and prey upon them, it makes sense that that predatory nature would spill into your gospel. So I guess I get it with Mike, but it still just seems so bleak.
You know, whenever you talk through some of these things, it forces your mind to think about it as you speak. And so
yeah.
I think many of the people who are in these movements, if they were to just actually talk about what the minister said during Sunday service after church, if they were to repeat it, I think many of them would just wake up and leave, right? But more than that, if you go back and you study some of the histories and just talk about what you've read, people would just snap out of it, because we have been taught this false mythology of where all of this came from. You mentioned Azusa Street Revival, for example. I grew up hearing that phrase over and over, not just with the church I was in, but many of the other churches too, the Pentecostal churches. It's this mythological event that the written history matches not even close to what they've made it into. And you go back, and so it was supposed to be, like you said, God giving the voice to the ministers, and they were able to speak sermons without the Doctor of Divinity degrees, because God speaking, giving them their messages entirely. Well, you go back and you read it, and they were so filled with spiritual ecstasy that they were actually preaching with just one or two words of an entire passage of the Bible and just totally cramming whatever it is they wanted to say about that word. To the extent there were people who actually claimed that God had given them the power to read their Bibles when they were illiterate, and they would get up to preach and they couldn't read it at all. But what they were doing was just repeating words that they had heard, you know. And so there were reporters there who weren't in the spiritual ecstasy, who were just writing what they saw. So they weren't caught up in the hype. And they're like, this doesn't make any sense. What is this? And that kind of thing grew and grew until another aspect of the revival that not many people in the Pentecostal movement will admit. There were a large number of women who left their husbands because their husbands was like, I'm not going into that nonsense. So they actually left their husbands and they were flirting with men on the streets and luring them into the revival. And that's one of the things, one of the things that grew it into this big thing, right? You can actually go read articles where they're doing this. And where it went from there, they created this authoritarian structure that did not really exist prior to this. But they created the idea through British Israelism that we, the Gentiles, are the bride and the bridegroom is coming. But more than that, we're setting up an authoritarian structure for the church. So God is the bride, Jesus is the bride to the church. The church is headed by the minister. The minister is the spiritual husband of the congregations. Mm. Well, this exploded into, I cannot remember the name, but on my website, there are churches where the quote-unquote spiritual husbands were practicing all of the joys of the husband to the women in his church and recording it and filming it, which was slightly illegal in his country.
Wow.
So yeah. It's just, whenever you have something that is just so blatantly wrong in its foundation, you're going to end up with all kinds of nonsense.
Well, so do you think that in some ways, this bridal paradigm, which is probably not how it was described before, but this idea of the metaphor of Jesus as the groom and the church as the bride, and then having that sort of structure and authority placed upon the way that the church is, do you think that was sort of a way to regain a sort of hierarchical structure? Like, because you don't have a typical hierarchical structure in Pentecostal churches. And so if there's this sort of patriarchal structure that like is instituted within these churches, it gives a measure of that structure back to the church, but it gives the male pastor or the male, you know, husband within a community, like gives him basically still authority over other individuals while maintaining this sort of Wild West, anybody can talk to the Lord sort of method.
You know, I've thought long and hard about that exact question. Where did it come from and why? If you look back at the early days of the revival, it was so much out of control. Charles Fox Parham, he wasn't able to take part in the revival because he was in some trouble for molesting a young man. I've covered that history pretty well. His partner, his student, William Joseph Seymour, spearheaded the revival. Within days, weeks, it grew so far out of his control that he actually wrote back and by letter to Charles Fox Parham and said, what do I do? This is out of my control. These people are crazy, basically is what he said. And it was. There were occultists who were coming into this thing. And I mean, people who had been practicing seances were coming into the Azusa Street Revival. And oh, glory to God and glory to whatever seance they're demon that they're bringing up, to the extent that whenever somebody was to stand and even like praise God or seeking for their salvation, if they began to get a little bit out of line, they would actually kick them out forcibly and injure them. I've got newspaper articles of that on the website. My latest book, Christian Identity to the NAR, covers a lot of that history and has some of the quotes about that. But it did grow largely out of control during the revival, but then the revival spread and Pentecostalism just kind of dissipated. I think for me, where I'm leaning towards what brought all this about, it got to the point where by the late 40s, whenever this was reinventing itself into the Latter Rain movement, people were largely more aware than they were back in the early 1900s. And so what would happen is people who did not have a full constraint over their critical thinking would go ask questions or talk to the news media, and it was turning into a different kind of chaos. They were actually news media that were critical of the revivals, and they were actually covering the revivals as they were happening and all of these alleged healings. One newspaper article said, I went all through tours in Canada. I did not see one single person healed. They would come in their stretchers and their crutches, and they would leave on the same stretchers and crutches. Now, there were some people healed, don't get me wrong, but the critical thinking would have taken over, and so they had to control it. So they started setting up hierarchies where they could forcibly control the people, is what it looks like to have happened. Now, I don't know. Okay. I'm still forming an opinion, but it seems to be a combination of both, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I've seen a lot of the same things that you're talking about, and even just from reading a lot of the work that you've done about the early Pentecostal days, and it is that very like decentralized chaos, Wild West. That's what, when I try to tell Orthodox Christian or individuals who did not grow up, especially if it was like international, if you go to, you know, England, there was definitely some of this going on, not just in the United States, but describing what the Pentecostal church is and what birthed the charismatic church is to individuals who are Catholic or have been in more structured liturgy or liturgical settings. Is very difficult because it just is, that's the only thing that I can say is this Wild West, just there's no real authority, but then some authority did emerge from it. And it's hard to really, even like when you read books that are talking about the structure, the authority structure within the NAR now, I think a lot of very interesting, very like well-researched individuals miss the mark a little bit, because like there is this big analysis of the NIR church, and the book was an excellent book. I'm forgetting what his name is right now, but he was looking at it from the perspective of like the church that birthed some of the Trump movement and some of the right wing Christian identity movement that has emerged recently. And he identified like Lance Wallnau as one of the movers behind the scene who is orchestrating a lot of this. And it was really funny because just as someone who grew up with my dad, who was preaching and talking to these different individuals, I don't know about now. I haven't seen it in the last, 5 years or whatever. But Lance Wallnau didn't know. I don't know if I should be saying this, but no one respected Lance Wallnau. No, like he was just a dude who was saying stuff who wanted to be at the front of everything. He wanted to have his name up there with other individuals. And so it's not that he wasn't super well respected or anything like that, but he definitely wasn't looting or leading or orchestrating the movement. I don't know if anybody really was, because I don't think that that's the type of movement that it is. I don't think that there is a hierarchical authority. I think that you have all of these little kings of their kingdoms. And that's where I was getting at some of the misogyny of it, the patriarchy of it, is that some version of a misogynistic patriarchal gospel gives you, if you're a man, the freedom to be the king of your own little castle, however small that might be. And like, that was how it was with my dad in our household. That's how it was with Mike Bickle in the larger IHOP kingdom, is that everyone was their kind of own authority. And you can see that with the way that like these individuals butt heads, and it's this sort of, yeah, territorial, I have my territory, you have your territory, being behind the scenes and hearing some of the like feuding that goes on behind these churches, and realizing that it's a lot more superficial and a lot sillier than you think. Like, it's not this organized structure. That's how it seemed to me. I don't have a complete understanding. I don't have my PhD in this. I have my experience in this. And it comes from like a very anecdotal place. I don't think that the Pentecostal community has ever really gotten away from that Wild West kind of anything goes. It has been this sort of wrestling. Maybe individuals started putting more structure into it so that they could keep the magic tricks going. Like, it became more stage productions than it became the organization of an actual church. It was more, hey, how do we keep this momentum going? I think certainly every revival looks more like that. You tell me what you think of this, but you have these different revival movements, and you have a bunch of different revivalists playing. They all play the sort of same tricks that each other are playing at the time. Those tricks die out and they have to find new tricks. And then another revival starts based off of a total different game plan. That's how it's always seemed to me.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the latter rain, charismatic, and other fringe movements into the new apostolic reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support.
I'm actually glad that you brought it up in the way that you did, because what I said before doesn't tell the whole story, and there isn't really a good way. It's such a complicated mess. There's not a good way to tell the story. So recently, and this hit today, so when this podcast comes out, it will have been out for a few weeks.
Yeah.
The city of Tucson published a series of articles exposing the Branham cult. We talked about it briefly before. And interviewed cult headquarters and started talking about some of the very horrific things that have happened because of Branham and the Latter Rain movement and the deaths involved, you know. So while interviewing cult headquarters could very easily deny all of it by simply saying, we don't have a structure that governs all of the splinter groups, is essentially what they said. And he didn't use these exact words, but in their way of saying it, this is by design. We do not want to have a simple central governing committee, because if we do, then we hold responsibility for all of this mess that has been created. So what happens is each mess that rises up, like International House of Prayer, they are their own entity. Whenever they take the fall, they just go down while the rest of it stays intact. And it is by design, but it's such a mess, man. Whenever I left the the religion, I had been indoctrinated to think that was a good thing and not a bad thing. It was a good thing to have independent churches. And then I started attending churches where there were some semblance of governance. And I started to understand, well, that's checks and balances. It keeps people from doing the things like we're talking about. And it's not that they're, you know, in the Branham cults, they referred to it like the Catholic Church and the Pope, and they said this hierarchy comes straight from Rome. It's from the pits of hell. They would say things like this. But when you go to the mainstream Christian churches, it isn't really so much that they're trying to control the minister in his doctrinal doctrinal positions. It's more to the fact that if you join into the denomination, you should have a shared belief, or otherwise you wouldn't be here in the first place. But while you're here, do not do these things that can potentially be dangerous. That's really what it came down to.
Totally. I'm actually working with individuals who have been involved with some of the Catholic Church and advocacy for, because so I'm starting to work with some advocacy for victims of abuse in clergy settings, right? And there's been precedent for this in the Catholic Church, obviously. In the last 20, 30 years, there's been huge scandals with the Catholic Church and systemic abuse in there. And there's been something like, I can't remember if it was hundreds of millions of dollars or maybe even billions of dollars of money paid out in lawsuits because of the abuse that was gone on in these Catholic denominations. And it's interesting because I genuinely think that some of the charismatic individuals saw what was going on in the Catholic Church and maintains this sort of anonymity and from different, having these different, like you said, splinter groups and different no direct accountability systems, because when it started unraveling for the Catholic Church, there were people to hold accountable for it, and there was money to be given out to there was lawsuits to be had. I have spoken with different lawyers about bringing suits against some of these individuals who were committing clergy abuse and whatnot. And there's movement on it, but I guarantee you there would be a lot more movement if there was any authority structure, because they can just, like, IHOPKC can just dissolve and disappear. And who are you going to hold accountable for it? The assets are spread out, and the assets have been given to other independent organizations that no longer have any ties to IHOP. Mike Bickle did this where he structured IHOP so that there was legitimately 20 different nonprofits that all were in the sort of IHOP umbrella, and they would switch assets to different organizations in order to skirt around financial transparency, and in this case now, to avoid lawsuits taking things from them. When I spoke up about my father, I found out that in 2015, there was a woman who was abused by my father that I didn't realize about this. This was 2017. And she came forward and sent an email to IHOP leadership and to Mike Bickle. And Mike Bickle responded and was like, Bob Hartley is not a part of our organization. He's not, I have no authority over Bob Hartley. Now, as a friend of my father, and as really a kind of older brother figure, Mike Bickle could have spoken to my dad just as a human being and been like, because it was true, he didn't actually have any authority over my father. But my father's ministry was launched through the International House of Prayer and through that entire community. So Mike is like, kind of washes his hands of it and says, this is not for me. I don't have anything to do with this. I had no idea about that too. Like I didn't realize that those emails had been sent. My dad had told me some version of that story, but he had made it sound extremely different, where he was the victim and this woman wasn't the victim and all this, you know, sad, crazy stuff. So I had no idea. And then within this last year, a lot of that information has kind of come out. And I realized, too, someone had also spoken to leadership at Bethel in Redding, California. And the same thing. Bethel was like, he's an independent minister. He's spoken here before, but he's not ours. We can't tell him what to do. When I then called Bethel leadership, I don't know if I've told you this story. I think I have, but my dad was moved basically to Redding, California after some of this abuse had been exposed and was realizing that he was abusing women, like pretty habitually abusing women, and using prophecy to get women into like vulnerable positions to abuse them. And some of them were coming forward to me because they couldn't come to either IHOP or Bethel. No one seemed to take them seriously or care about it. So in order to bring accountability, once I started speaking up, some of these women ended up coming to me. I hear their stories. They're obviously just heartbreaking stories, obviously heartbreaking for me because this is my own father who's the perpetrator of this abuse. So I call up both IHOP leadership and Bethel leadership. IHOP leadership does, they're having their whole scandal with Mike Pickle during this time. And they're like, okay, we're gonna ban Bob Hartley from the premise and we're gonna speak out against them. So they kind of cut it off right away. They don't have any problem. They're like, it kind of was good for them. They're like, let's distract and throw the heat onto this guy. But Bethel doesn't, I'm talking to them. I gave all of the information to them. I spoke to Bill Johnson specifically, sent him an email about it. We had a back and forth. And then like 2 days later, Bill Johnson invites my dad to a prophetic conference and like saves a seat for him. Right after I spoke to him about, hey, my dad is not mentally well. He's abusing individuals. He's using prophecy to do this. And he's using the authority that you, by just grafted into your guys' community. So I give him all the game plan of it. I'm like, this is my own father. I'm not making this shit up. Like this is, I'm telling you this authentically. He seemed to even believe me. And then 2 days later, he saves a seat for my father because Bethel's culture of honor, they don't, you know, want to dishonor the prophets or whatever. And so then I have to speak out of it publicly. I start tweeting about it, and there's more sort of Bethel gets in kind of hot water. They call me up and it's the same thing. It's like, hey, we can't tell your dad what to do. We're just a church. Like there's no authority and structure. And it's like, my dad wouldn't have a ministry if it wasn't for IHOP and if it wasn't for Bethel. So to hear from both of the leadership of those communities be like, hey, this isn't us. It's like, well, who the hell else is it? Like, it's not me. Like, he got this authority by growing in these church communities, in these ministry communities. Like, that's how he has his authority. And yeah, you can't tell him what to do, but you can warn your community, hey, this individual is not safe. And like, don't go to house church meetings with him. Don't go to these private gatherings, you know, it's gross. It's not, you know, you don't want to do that. It's bad look for you, bad look for them, you know, all of these things, but it's the only way to properly deal with reality in that situation. And this is almost exactly verbatim the conversation that I had with them. And then eventually they did say, hey, okay, we're going to send out an email and warn our staff. They never said anything publicly, but we're going to warn our staff. Bob Hartley is not going to be allowed on the premise anymore, which, you know, was a little bit of a relief to me just because it felt like, okay, I felt this weight of having to prevent future abuse from happening. I don't have that full capacity to do that, but I need to at least do what I can with it. But it went back to this system of zero accountability. And they were talking to me like, oh, I wish we could do something. And it's like, you have established this system. You are the ones who invite in ministers without having any sort of accountability. You just have anybody come and give your platform to the latest magician who is doing their trick. And as long as it boosts your numbers, then great. You know, like that there, you set up the system of accountability. Don't tell me there's nothing that you can do as if it is something beyond your control. This is how the world has been set up. So the Wild West of it all is clearly an intentional piece of the pie. It's clearly something that has been structured in order to avoid accountability. The same thing happened. I don't know if you've spoken about the Bethany Deaton scandal. Has anyone spoken to you about the Bethany Deaton scandal?
Yeah, I think brought it up in the podcast with Brantley.
Yeah, so I won't retell the full story at all then, that was one of the biggest scandals in IHOP KC history. It's crazy that that's just one of the biggest scandals, because it's a horrific scandal where a young woman dies in very mysterious circumstances. It is ruled sort of a suicide, but someone comes forward and confesses to murdering her. I'm just giving the bullet points just in case people hadn't seen this. She is a part of a IHOP. She's a part of like the IHOP community, and then she's in a house church that's all IHOP students. There was a lot going on with that, and I don't want to get wrapped up into telling the whole entire story, but the basics of it is that she dies. Someone comes forward and confesses to the murder. It turns out that IHOP leadership had gotten a hold of one of the individuals who was within her small group, had brought him in for like a deliverance session that lasted like something like 20 hours or 12. I can't remember how long, but like basically the whole day they have this deliverance session, and he eventually confesses to the murder of this young woman. And turns out he probably almost certainly did not do it, and he was just coerced into confessing to this murder. It is eventually ruled a suicide, but there's this big sort of mystery around what actually happened. Even if it was suicide, you know, IHOP got involved by doing this investigation on their own and coercing a confession, and it just was an absolute mess of a situation. But despite them actually actively being involved and actively getting an individual to confess, the way that IHOP talked about it was exactly how you had just talked about it previously of what Branham had done, where it's like, oh, it's just all these splinter groups. We don't have any accountability. Like they took the house church of all IHOP students and they pretended like that was something totally distinct and separate from their community, and was like, hey, there was just this like crazy cult community within IHOP. We're not a cult. That little house church was a cult. And in that cult, some bad things happened to this woman, but we don't have anything wrong with IHOP itself. Same thing happened when there was a young couple were fasting. And they had an infant, and the mother was fasting, and the infant died of malnutrition because it wasn't getting any nutrition from the mother because she was fasting. And the mother and the father end up going to prison for child neglect. But again, International House of Prayer, zero accountability. There's no like, hey, our system of fasting, which we were going to talk about today, and I totally forgot about. But our system of fasting, we're not gonna ask any questions about how this might have causally affected this horrific situation. We're not gonna have any accountability to this situation because those people were crazy. They should have known better, right? And we just, sometimes IHOP attracts the crazies. That's just how it is. It's quite diabolical when it's done habitually. Like when there is a consistent pattern of this, then it's like, oh, this is not just like something horrific happened and you're trying to distance yourself from it because you can't square those two things. That's one thing. But when it's a continual pattern of it, of causing these horrific events to happen or being really, you know, involved in these really horrific atrocities and then continually insulating yourself from any consequences of that, even just consequences and accountability within the system, even just taking responsibility to change and to update policies is absolutely wild.
You know, the real power of the New Apostolic Reformation is its networks. They've got all of these networks of these apostolic groups that they all band together. And then the superstars within each network get to cross-pollinate. So they'll invite them over, and here's superstar one. He's got our pulpit for this week, for this convention, this revival, whatever. And then he goes home. But in the end, it starts looking like a really poorly written series by Tom Cruise. He's going to come, he's going to get disavowed, and then we're going to forget him until we bring him back the next time. Then he'll get disavowed again, then we'll forget him, then he comes back again. You know, same plot as the as the movies. I do like the movies, but there's no plot to them. But what's really interesting, you mentioned fasting, and we're going to have to talk about that probably in another podcast, but the core, the main sect of the Branham movement from which all of this originated has completely disavowed the fasting, which is really, really interesting if you think about it. I have recordings of William Branham and Franklin Hall, the guy who invented the fasting that all of this came from. They're sharing the pulpit together, and Franklin Hall saying, "What are we going to start with, William Branham? A little money, ha, 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 ha." And he starts laughing about it, the money they're raking in with this fasting doctrine. And so this whole thing developed from fasting, and it created problems way back in the early days of Latter Rain. And so they were disavowing Franklin Hall and his fasting doctrine back in the 50s. And then it sort of continued. There were some splinter groups that still did it to the same levels. And then, you know, fast forward till today, it's almost completely disavowed. But there are many splinter groups that pop up that they suddenly realize, wait a minute, fasting was part of the core history of this whole mythology. Let's try it and see what happens. And then they're surprised when it does the same thing that it did back then. And where does that shock come from?
It makes sense why it's a critical part of the larger strategy, because this sort of weakened and disconnected state from reality when you are, I don't know if you've ever, did you do much fasting?
I did, but not for religious reasons. And I wanted to mention that when we talked about doing this episode, did the podcast sometime back, and there was a comment made that fasting lowers your A1C. And the way in which it was said, I got more emails about that than I did of any of the doctrines that we talked about. They're like, no, it doesn't. I understood what they said. I have diabetes, and I thought I had conquered it through fasting. And if you're fasting daily, I lost 45 pounds in 45 days. And during the course of this time, I was watching blood sugar numbers go down daily. Well, when your blood sugar numbers go down daily, your A1C also does. It's a consequence of the fasting. So you can cut out carbs, and it's one of the things that you can bring diabetes into remission if you do it for a sustained period of time. However, there are other complications, as you know, with fasting.
Right.
So there are pros and cons. You have to balance it all out. In the end, where it comes out to is, when you're doing it because you want to do it and you have a reason to do it, whether it's spiritual or, in my case, it was physical. I needed to lose the 45 pounds, so it was really good for me. I was in control. I had it. But it wasn't being, I wasn't being manipulated into doing it for the wrong reasons. And there are people who, for their health's sake, they shouldn't do it in the first place. They're not right in a healthy state where they even could be doing it, and their doctors would recommend it against it. You don't find any of these ministers that are promoting this fasting, hyper-fasting doctrine. Please go to your doctor first and then do this thing. It's right, let's do this and you may die, but they don't tell you the right you may die part.
Well, and there's different types of fasting, of course, too, with like, you know, when I, so it's interesting in California talking about fasting. If I was to talk about fasting to, you know, anybody in the, on the street, their mind is probably going to go to the, for health reasons, you spend, you know, one day you fast or you fast for 18 hours or something like that. Or in other, you know, in like Islam, there's that you fast from sun up to sundown, you know, throughout the entire day. But that wasn't the fasting that I was a part of. Our fasting were these like long stretches of times. Minimum was 3 days. You couldn't call it a fast if it was less than 3 days. Sometimes it would be like there's the Daniel fast where you only eat fruits and vegetables. Sometimes there's different types of fasting. Like there was a juice fast where you would drink like naked juices or whatnot to keep some vitamins and minerals, but you're not putting anything in substance because you're having that continual hunger, which my dad tried to always find a way around that. Like I remember one of the first fasts that I remember as like a kid, I was 8 or 9. I wasn't fasting, but I remember my dad was fasting and he was doing a juice fast and he got so hungry. He literally bought like a McDonald's cheeseburger and he put it in a smoothie and he tried to blend it and then drank it. And which was of course disgusting. And I very viscerally remember that his like burger juice smoothie and how disgusted I was by that. But anyway, you know, there's these, when I then got older and I was doing fast myself, it was that sort of thing of 3 days, just water, 7 days, just water. The most that I ever did was 12 days, just water. Which as a kid, that's a really, really long time. Some were doing these 21-day fasts. And I'll tell you, if you are a secular individual and you do not believe in demons, you do a 21-day fast or a 12-day fast, you'll start believing in demons. Because, and that's what I was saying, like, I get why fasting breaks this sort of mysticism, breaks into this sort of mystical world, because man, you start seeing things, you start hearing things, or at least I did. And I would feel this sort of like dizzy. Sometimes it would feel a little euphoric. Sometimes it was just like an anemia. I mean, it was just anemia. And I just was going to faint. And I was like that close to fainting all these different times. And genuinely the most spiritual experience is having like that bowl of chicken noodle soup or whatever you do to end it. Like that's when God visits you, is when you finally, finally eat. But it's just when you're in that sort of weakened state, you will believe things that you would have never believed before, you know? I'm like, why not just do ayahuasca? Why not just go for it and do all of these things? If it's about making your mind experience these supernatural things, then there's a lot of other ways to do it, you know? I'm not saying that people actually should do that. It's silly to me that in certain like IHOP communities that doing something like food deprivation for extended period of days is normalized as fine, and that like we are basing our entire religion off of visions that individuals are having at the end of these experiences. It's no different than basing your vision off of some ayahuasca experience that someone's having, because it's just they're not in their right mind.
Well, in the end, you know, it's really no different than whenever, if you're being manipulated into fasting for spiritual ecstasy so that you can have these experiences, it's no different than dropping acid. I mean, the same end result, and it's not at all, I know they preach it as this holy thing. It's not this holy thing if you're being manipulated to doing it. That's really, really the problem. But we've got to talk more about that. I have much, much more to say about the fasting. So
sure.
we'll talk about that next time. If you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the NAR, read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and soon Audible.